Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Welcome. Glad you tuned in today. Happy Wednesday to you. Well, we've got an important show for you today. I'm so looking forward to having Philip Yancey on this show. He's going to help us unpack suffering in the life of the believer. And we're going to talk with him for the first half of the show. Second half of the show, we'll talk with a woman who stood in the path of a gunman, and God used her to prevent a massive school shooting. So we're really unpacking the whole idea of suffering, the suffering that God allows us to walk through and the suffering that he at times protects us from. But there is the age-old question, why does God allow suffering? If he's good, why does he allow it? So here's my question for you to think about as we unpack today's show. What have you learned about God through the things that you've suffered? What have you learned about God through the things you've suffered? Well, let me tell you about my first guest today, and we'll get this conversation started. Philip Yancey is a prolific author and journalist who's invited to speak around the world on the topic of suffering. His books include What's So Amazing About Grace, What Good Is God, and The Jesus I Never Knew. And we've got his material hooked up at our website. You can connect with him there at myfaithradio.com. Philip, such an honor to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Well, we love to start out our conversations every single day talking scripture, and it's always so wonderful to hear from our guests just if there's a verse that's just been jumping off the page at you, if there's a life verse, because it, to me, it brings the Word of God to life in such a profound way. Is there a verse that God's been speaking to you about, or you have a life verse you'd like to share?
There is. I know I'm supposed to be talking about this book that just came out, but of course I've been working on my next book.
I know how that goes. Your head is right there, isn't it?
It's a book called Vanishing Grace, Whatever Happened to the Good News. And it's about how to relate to a post-Christian society that has some hostility toward Christians. And the other day, I came across a verse that hit me so strongly I decided to make it an epigraph for the whole book. It's from Hebrews 12:15, and it says very clearly, "See to it that no one misses the grace of God." And I thought, that's what we Christians should be about. We should see to it that no one misses the grace of God. Mm. And it just fit exactly what I was
Love
working
it. On. You know, it's so interesting because, you know what we're seeing too? We see to it that no one uses a wrong word or says it wrong or aligns with the wrong person. That's so concerning to me. It's like the things we jump on as Christians
right.
are anything but that, it seems, right?
Yeah, and I think that's something we've got to address, or
yep.
We're going to just work ourselves out of out of business. And obviously, there's a lot of concern about the next generation. Often it's the ungraciousness that turns them away from church.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my guests recently said, we've got to trust the Holy Spirit's voice in their lives. I mean, walk in truth, definitely, and not, you know, depart from the things God has entrusted to us. But there's a winsome, loving way to walk this out so that people, they're not just receiving from us our anger and our rant. And so, of course, that comes up for, you know, every once in a while on the show because I have such a burden that we do see to it that people don't miss this good news because it's
right.
Amazing news. And
right.
I appreciate that so much. Well, you open this book, The Question That Never Goes Away, The Question Is Why. You open it with a gripping story about your father. I was sitting here and I actually sat in my cubicle and I gasped because I just didn't expect it to end the way it did. So would you mind if sharing that story with us?
Yes, I don't have any conscious memory of this. I was only 1 year old, but this was in 1950. And in those days, the feared disease was not AIDS, it was polio. And my father was 24 years old, young, vibrant person. I still have a Bible that has story after story of people that he led to Christ. So great potential in front of him. He was planning to be a missionary in Africa, and he already had his supporters all lined up, prayer supporters, financial supporters, a list of several thousand people, actually. He got polio, and it was a severe case. He was paralyzed so that he could not even breathe on his own. He was put in an iron lung machine that did his breathing for him. And while he was there, these Christians were praying, and the people closest to him just couldn't imagine that he could die. I mean, that God could, quote, take him. And so they became convinced that he would be healed. And he did as well. And with his cooperation and everybody's advice, except the doctor's, against the doctor's advice, he was removed from that iron lung and he died just a few days later. My whole life from that point on was lived under the shadow of what I now see as an error in theology. People thought they knew God's will and they didn't. And it was just one illustration of how we can get this whole issue of suffering wrong. And when we get it wrong, it can have pretty dire consequences.
You know, indeed, I just had lunch with a young woman today, and we were talking about the difference between expectations and expectancy. And I was telling her, when we predetermine an outcome and then ask God to show up and do what we think he should do because we've built a faith case around it, and then he doesn't, our faith is weakened. And there's such a difference between this expected outcome and an expectancy that God's writing a story and that he's very much involved, but he gets to write the story. And you sure can see, especially for the suffering person, if people give them their pat answers and try to tie it up in a bow, they're doubly burdened, aren't they?
They are. And I know you're based in the Twin Cities, and I remember reading kind of a debate, a very cordial debate between a couple of your pastors, I think it was John Piper and Greg Boyd, on the will of God, exactly what is the will of God. And that's confusing to a lot of people. So confusing that I no longer talk about the will of God when it comes to suffering. I talk about the desire of God. Because we can't really know God's will. We couldn't understand it if God explained it. And generally he doesn't, not even to people like Job. But we do know God's desire because God gave us a face. God visited earth. And if you follow Jesus around, each time he meets someone with suffering, he never says something about God's will or you did something to deserve this. He contradicts that, and he responds with healing and with comfort. And he taught us to pray that God's will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. Well, we know that in heaven there is no suffering. There's no pain. There's no death. There are no tears. And our job as Christians is to be part of that solution, to bring comfort and hope so that God's will is being done more on earth as it is in heaven.
Well, when you consider Auschwitz or the Rwandan genocide or the tsunami in Japan, it seems like anything you'd try to say to speak to that would somehow trivialize the pain because it's the gravity of it is, you know, inexplicable. So is there anything to say? I mean, I would be so afraid to sound trite in any way in trying to figure that out. You know what I mean? What do you say in a situation like that? Because you've met people, you've traveled in these lands of suffering. What do you say?
That's right. That's right. Well, I wouldn't say this, but one behind-the-scenes thing is that suffering is not a mathematical thing. For instance, I tell stories in this book. Some were based in the tsunami in Japan. Some were based in Newtown, Connecticut, where the school shooting took place at Sandy Hook. 20,000 people were killed in Japan. 20 children were killed at Sandy Hook. And you can't say, okay, 20,000, 20... the suffering in Japan was 1,000 times or 10,000 times worse. It doesn't work like that. Suffering is suffering. All pain is pain. And it's actually one person at a time. So you got 20,000 individual people who are feeling that pain, and you've got 20 individual people and their families who are feeling that pain. And that's how it hits us. So it doesn't really help much to try to compare my suffering to somebody else's. It usually makes me feel worse, you know. Maybe I have a broken leg and I hear my neighbor has cancer, so I think, well, I shouldn't be concerned about my broken leg because he's so much worse off. It doesn't work that way. Whatever you have, whether it's depression or something that seems small, is the very thing that is going to bring up the same questions as the tsunami and the big things. What would I say to those people? Well, you're right. I have been with them. The first thing I would say is if you feel confusion and grief and outrage, you're in good company because there's a lot of that in the Bible. About two-thirds of the Psalms, most of the prophets, Lamentations, Habakkuk, the whole book of Job. It's okay to have that feeling that there's something wrong with this world. In fact, I would go further and say, if you feel upset about things that go on in this world, you can only imagine how God feels.
Yeah.
So, if you feel grief, if you feel rage, you can only imagine how God feels. We know that because when Jesus visited Earth, he responded to pain not like the Buddha, saying we have to overcome it, but by throwing himself on the ground, saying, if there's any other way, let me out. And when he experienced pain himself and death, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He knew what it was like to live on a broken planet. I would start there, and then I'd also say that God is on the side of the sufferer. When something bad happens, it's natural, it's instinctive to think, I did something to deserve this. God is punishing me. And we do that, and some Christians cruelly say that to people who are going through hard times. I could tell you why I don't believe that, but I do strongly believe that God is on the side of the sufferer. Again, go back to Jesus. See how he handled a widow who just lost her child, or even a Roman soldier whose servant fell ill. He didn't respond with philosophizing. He didn't respond with judgment. He responded with compassion, with comfort, and healing. Mm. God is on the side of the sufferer. And we're told in 2 Corinthians that God is the God of all comfort. Love that phrase. And that we should be about spreading that comfort abroad in the world. It's a beautiful passage on what we should be doing in a world of pain.
Oh, indeed. And he's near to the brokenhearted. I love that. And to save those who are crushed in spirit. And a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he'll not snuff out. I mean, he so cares about the broken and the hurting. Talking to Philip Yancey today, he's got a beautiful new book out, The Question That Never Goes Away. And the question is, why? In fact, Philip, I recently talked with Kirk Cameron, and he said that this why question has turned believers into atheists. And I know from my own life, when I ask certain questions that cause me even greater despair, I realize I'm asking the wrong questions, because you can frame suffering or frame hardship in a way that actually weakens your faith. And so, like, this might be true, but this is truer still. So what have you found to help people when that why question almost debilitates them?
I turned a corner when I was invited to Newtown. As you mentioned early in the program, it was years ago I wrote a book called Where Is God When It Hurts? I was 27 years old. I had no business jumping into the problem of pain at that age. But it was a challenge of faith for me. It's the kind of thing that does turn people into atheists. And so now, 35 years later, I decided to revisit the topic. And it really came about after I was invited to speak on the topic of the first book, Where Is God When It Hurts? Newtown, Connecticut. I knew with the stuff going on there, with the shroud of grief over that town, I couldn't just go to my file and pull out some speech I'd given somewhere else. I had to wrestle with what they were wrestling with. I had to put myself in their place. There were going to be parents who had lost their children, firemen, first responders, policemen, school teachers who were there and saw it all. And I happened to be reading a bunch of the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, for an article I was writing unrelated. It occurred to me as I was preparing that there's one question that's even harder than where is God when it hurts, and that is where is no God when it hurts. Because these guys said that the whole universe, and especially humanity, we're just a random act. It will never be repeated. Dawkins says we live in a blind, pitiless universe. And I noticed that that week, as I was preparing, the New York Times was using their op-ed pages by inviting pastors, priests, and rabbis to speak. There weren't any new atheists. And for a minute there, I put myself in the foot of somebody like Richard Dawkins. What would I say to the folks at Newtown, Connecticut? And frankly, I couldn't think of any words of comfort or hope. So then I started asking, well, what words of comfort and hope do I have? I do believe that God is on the side of the sufferer. I do believe that God is as upset about what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary School as the people who were there. And I do believe that I could stand in front of those parents and say, you want to see your child again. Your child is safe in the arms of God right now. Not everybody believes that, but that is a word of comfort and hope that I believe as a Christian that we can hold out that you don't get. And so you don't get from other sources like atheism. And so what I thought was going to be this huge challenge to my faith actually turned out to be an affirmation of what I believe, that we really do have something substantive and transformative to offer a world that faces tragedy like that.
Powerful. Well, you write that Christians sometimes tend to offer contradictory counsel to those who suffer. I would love for you to say a word or two about things we can say, things we shouldn't say.
Yes. When I was a young journalist, I interviewed a lot of people who had been through tragedy. That's what journalism does, right? We find people with stories. And again, they would tell me when I was lying in the hospital just trying to recover, the church made it worse. People would come in with these theories, you know, God's punishing you for something you did wrong. You need to use this time to really think about your life. And the next person would come in, no, it wasn't God. It was the devil. The devil's attacking you because you're being used by God. And then the next person would come in, no, it wasn't the devil. It was God, but not because he doesn't like you, but because he likes you. He's chosen you as an example to others. And they would say to me, I just want to get well. You know, I can't figure this stuff out. And that's really why I wrote my first book and why I keep revisiting this topic, because so many things that come to our lips that are well-intentioned. I don't want to dump on people here. They're well-intentioned, and we want to say something because we feel awkward around somebody in pain. So we maybe rely on a platitude like, all things work together for good. Well, that's a true statement. It's in Romans 8. But the timing of it, when a person is barely hanging on, be careful when you even say something like that. Or at a funeral, somebody wrote me the other day and said they had lost a child, a four-year-old child, and somebody came up to them several times and said, oh, well, at least you've got another one.
Oh, I know. Heard that,
and,
too.
And, you know, that doesn't help the void that was created by the death of the four-year-old.
Or that God needed another angel.
That
one I've heard numerous times from parents who say,
a little flower in heaven.
Yeah.
Right? Or that something you can say to a child. You can say, God needed your daddy in heaven. Well, wait a minute. I need my daddy too. Mm-hmm. You know, and it sets up a dissonance there between God and the child. What I have learned from people when I say what helps and what doesn't help, they tend to immediately describe what doesn't help. What I've learned is a simple physical presence, touch, and an I'm sorry. And then let the person going through it set the pace of how much they want to talk.
Yeah.
Some people really need to unload. They need to process out loud. They need to get the grief out. They need to sob. Some people just don't want to talk about it. They're not ready. And there's no formula that you can use because people are different. But mainly, bite your tongue as much as possible. I go back to Job. He had three friends, Job's comforters, they're called, but that's always in quotes because they didn't really comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Except when they came there initially, they sat down, tore their clothes, put ashes on their head. They were so upset by what had happened to Job, they sat there in silence for 7 days and seven nights. And that's when they comforted Job. It's when they opened their mouths that the problem started.
Exactly.
And that's a lesson I need to learn too. Because we want to say something, try not to. You're there just to offer presence and to be available for anything that needs doing. And, you know, another well-intentioned thing that people often tell me, especially right after an event, they'll say, people come up, if you ever need anything, just let me know. You know, I'm here. Be more specific than
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe even say, I'm bringing a meal over. I don't want to bother you. I'll leave it on your front porch.
There
or,
you know, go.
Yeah, where you're a little taking
there
some initiative.
Go.
And
yeah,
when we went through a terrible time, I was battling a disease as a young mom, Lyme disease, and a number of people brought dishes, but that was before the Gladwares days, the plastic, you know. And so they would bring them in glass dishes, and I probably had five voice messages. Can you meet me at that gas station and bring my glass dish?
Oh, no.
Like,
oh, no.
I'll send you some money because I can't. but to make it as accommodating as possible for that person who's suffering. And it seems like there's been so many messages, the Americanized version maybe of Christianity with our entitlement and different things that kind of have muddied the waters when it comes to suffering. Because if there's an under undercurrent of belief that if you're suffering, you lack faith, and if you're blessed, you must have a lot of faith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, you think about how damaging that can be to the truly suffering person who's trying just to hang on to God in the middle of it all. But the truth is, you know, in this world, we're going to have trouble. And
yes,
this is a short chapter compared to the long story in eternity. And I love what you wrote here. You said, Christian hope promises that creation will be transformed. Until then, God evidently prefers not to intervene in every instance of evil or natural disaster. Rather, God has commissioned us as agents of intervention in the midst of a hostile and broken world. I'd love, Philippa, for you to just to say a little more about that, because, okay, there is suffering in this world. We have trouble. Let's not try to explain it away, as you've been saying. Let's move in and be the hands and feet. So say more about that.
I will. My favorite anchor chapter on this whole topic is Romans 8. It's a beautiful chapter, and it's cosmic and it's sweet. Paul talks about the whole creation, all of the universe groaning as if in the pains of childbirth, which is a wonderful metaphor, because there's a lot of pain involved in childbirth, but you get something worthwhile out of it. And there's a verse that I mentioned earlier that is sometimes misapplied. He says that for those who love God, all of the things that happen can work together for your good. He doesn't say only good things are going to happen. And in fact, later in that chapter, he spells out the things that have happened in his life. And he had a very troubled life. Arrest, torture, snake bite, shipwreck. He mentions some of those things. And then at the end of the chapter, he concludes nothing that happens, death, life, height, depth, space, time, nothing can separate us from the love of God. And when I look at that phrase, how God can use all of these things, some of which are bad things, the theologians use the word that God can redeem pain. In fact, Dallas Willard says about that chapter, to those who love God, nothing irredeemable can happen to you.
Ooh,
love
that
phrase.
That's good.
Yeah. Not too many people go around using that word these days, so I like to substitute the word recycler. God is the great recycler. When I turn in an old computer, they ship it somewhere, and these people open the back, and they take all these little worthless parts, little scrapes of rare earth and gold and stuff, and it's probably reincarnated into somebody's iPhone now, you know, the state-of-the-art little 4-inch thing that is smarter than my old computer used to be. And that's what God does. God takes the bad things that happen and somehow restores them, redeems them, recycles them into something that's good. We don't have a free pass. We don't. I mean, look at Paul. Look at Jesus. Look at the disciples. 10 of them died as martyrs. Bad things do happen. We live on a broken planet. But we also believe that God isn't going to put up with that broken planet forever. That promise all the way through the Bible. Jesus said before he left, I'm going away to prepare a place for you. In the meantime, we are the body of Christ, and we are commissioned to bring the comfort and hope that he brought in person when he was on earth. He's now commissioned us to bring that same comfort and hope to people all over the world.
You know, I'm thinking of David in that Battle of Ziklag when it seemed like even his closest friends were turning on him, and seems like the world is against him. But it says in that place, he strengthened himself in the Lord. And for the person who's looking at suffering, maybe they're not walking through suffering, but they're so disillusioned by everything that they see. You know, I feel like I do a little bit of advocacy work I have in the years past around human trafficking. Well, I always could tell that God gave me a portion of grace to carry a portion of that burden, but I could always tell when I got into a place where it was too much for me. We just have a minute left, but say a word just about how we strengthen ourselves in the Lord, whether we're walking through the suffering or not, so that we can keep a perspective of God.
Well, I would say, be honest. It's easy as Americans to kind of stuff it. Be honest with God and be honest with the people around you. It's so important. Suffering should come with a warning label. Do not practice this alone.
Amen.
You need a community, and a community of faith can be an important part of that healing process. Mm.
Well, Philip Yancey, we so appreciate your work and your faithfulness, and thank you for spending time with us today.
My pleasure, Susie.
Great to be with you. Please come back.
I'll do that.
I would love that. Philip's new book, again, is titled The Question That Never Goes Away. When we come back, we'll talk with Antoinette Tuff. She was a woman who stood in the way of a school shooting, and God used her profoundly to stop a tragedy that was about to happen. Don't go away. We'll be right back. wonderful show today. So glad you tuned in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. Just talked to Philip Yancey about his book, The Question That Never Goes Away. And it's the question of why, if God is good, why does he allow suffering? And you think about it, there are things that he lets us go through that it's hard to believe we've walked through them. But then we look back over our shoulder and we realize, you know what, he never left me. And I'm richer for it. I have spoils from that war. And I think that the stories that are going to take our breath away when we get to heaven, some of them anyway, are going to be the ones where we see the suffering he protected us from. And boy, the things that he's protected us from, I don't think we can fathom. Well, I am so excited to talk with my next guest today, an amazing woman with an amazing story of God's intervention. Let me tell you about her. Before she made headlines and talked to a school shooter back from the brink, Antoinette Tough was a woman who faced and overcame her own pain and hurt. Publicly recognized by President Obama for her courageous act, today she speaks around the world, spreading hope and sharing her inspiring message of how our lives prepare us for our own moments of purpose. And she has two children. Antoinette, honored to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show today.
Well, before we get to that day that really that gained public attention, I would love to just have this. I'm sorry, I'm tripping over my words. I'm battling a cold. That's my excuse today. Give us some backstory, if you would, on your faith journey and just some of the ways that God was preparing you in the days leading up to that day.
Well, I think God actually prepared for me for that day years before that. I think it started when I was a young girl with abandonment issues with my parents and also with going through not loving myself, looking for validation in all the wrong places. And so with that, God allowed me to now get this young man that I start loving and being in a relationship with when I was 13 years old. The man that I'm married to and have been married and have been with for 33 years. He now comes in and tells me months later that our marriage is no longer okay with him. He has now found another woman. And so what you do when what you thought was your life is no longer your life. And so now I'm actually faced with not only that, but now trying to figure out how do I survive without him being in my life, without him validating me, and how do I survive without that income to be able to support me and my children.
I can only imagine the fear. And as you say, because of past things prior to that, the lies already that the enemy had embedded in your soul of not being worth it, of insecurity and fear, boy, you sure can imagine what the enemy was shaking up in you. I'd love to know when you came to Christ along your journey.
Well, my mom has always taken us to church. So, you know, we started out with, you know, going to church on in Sunday school and, you know, you got 10:45 service and Sunday evening service and you end up with a chicken dinner at nighttime and still have church service. So I've had that foundation for a minute.
That's wonderful. And so when August 20 rolled around, 2013, were you in the process of a divorce at that time? Was your husband already gone? Or where were you at in your just personal journey at that point?
He was already gone.
Oh, and you were dealing?
He had already actually connected with his new family.
Oh, man.
It was just me and my son, who was multiple disabled, now trying to figure out how do we survive day to day on the same debt and less money.
Oh, my goodness.
How do you now survive with eating and this, the basic things that you need to have done when there's no support there? And so it was an overwhelming time for me, but God had my pastor, who is Apostle Ulysses Tough, do an anchoring sermon that Sunday. And so I had got up that Monday and said to God that I'm going to study this anchoring and just kind of understand how to anchor in him and not allow things of the world to just shake you, that you just be unmovable. And so I did that on Monday, and then I did that on Tuesday. And during my private time, nowhere did God actually say to me that this was going to happen to me hours later. Didn't give me any forewarning or anything. And so my son, who is 22, you know, he gets up and he likes the IHOP breakfast, I call it. He wants his bacon and eggs and got to have a little toast and some grits. And, you know, he wants some orange juice and a cup of coffee. And so I'm now getting him and getting that prepared for him, and now going and getting his lunch and dinner prepared, because I work 2 to 3 jobs a day. And so I'm now getting all that. And then when I get to school, my principal asks me if I can relieve the secretary for lunch. And so I'm like, okay. So I'm still there getting everything together. And lo and behold, I get this devastating phone call. The phone call now tells me that I need $14,000 unless I'm going to lose my car.
Mm.
So I now proceed to close the door to try to get myself together, as I am now bawling in tears, asking God why and what to do next. I am now late to pick up the secretary, and so she calls me to see where I'm at. So as we all do, I now put on a mask and now try to get myself up and to now go and to display how joyful I am, and, you know, and let everybody know this is a wonderful day.
Mm.
And so as I go out the door, one of the teachers come and asks me if I could help her with her insurance. And so I say to her, yes. Come walk with me in the front office, but only if she could have seen through all of that how I was falling apart on the inside, needing someone to rescue me on the outside. So we go to the front office, and now we're sitting there in the front relieving the secretary, and in comes Michael Hill. Young man dressed in all black with an AK-47, already ready to steal, kill, and destroy. So as I look at him, I say, okay, God, this has got to be a joke. I just got this phone call and everything else that's going on with my life. It has to be a joke. But little did I know until he spoke out of his mouth to allow me to know that everyone is going to die today, including him. As he goes now to tell the teacher to go and let everyone know that he's in the building.
And that teacher looks at you, should I go? And you calmly said, yes, go. And this is what's so amazing to me is you're devastated. You're just bleeding on the inside, heartbroken. You've got so much stress on you as a single mom and now this phone call. And then, but you took time in the morning before and the morning before to anchor yourself in the Lord. And even though he didn't give you this forewarning of something that was about to happen, you did have the word of God in you, and there's something, his peace landed on you in the midst of this horrifying situation, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
It's amazing to me. And so I'm reading this and picturing you sort of almost taking over, where it's like he didn't realize, but it was like God, Christ in you. There, you had control there in a way that he probably doesn't even realize. But she goes and tells people. Where did she even go? Did she just she ran down the hallway and said intruder alert, didn't she? That was what she did.
Yes, and because, see, there's 800 and some kids in that school. There's 3 levels to that school. So there are kids and people all over the place. And the time that Michael Hill came into the building, that's how I know it was God. That is the busiest time of the school year. That office would have normally been full of kids and the parents actually checking out their students at that time, and that one person came into the door to alarm them.
And so your kind of code phrase was intruder alert. So as she's running down the hallway, then people know that, and you hear the scurrying of desks and chairs and people kind of preparing that way, and that agitated him. So then what happened next?
So now he's out there agitated because of all the, you know, everything going on in commotion. So now he goes out to hold his gun up to now start shooting. And the media clerk is standing there, and so I'm saying to him, come back in here, come back in here. They're only doing what you told them to do. So it's all right. Do not go out there and do anything. They're only saying what you said for them to say and alarming everybody to know what's going on. And so then he looks and then looks at me and then looks over, it, not directly at me, but looks in that area because he never looked at me in my face. But he now looks around in the disarray of, okay, and then he comes back into the door.
Is that when he told you to go ahead and call the police?
Yes. That's when he told me to go ahead. No, he didn't tell me to call the police then. When he came back in, he was in there and he was still pacing.
Mm.
By that time, after he finished pacing, the cafeteria manager came in. And then the cafeteria manager came in, and then when he comes in, now he's actually agitating Michael because Michael is telling him to move and for him to get around the counter with me. And he does not move fast enough. And so that's when Michael fires his first shot in the office, feet away from us. And the bullet now ricochets in the office, small area, and it did not penetrate or hit anyone.
Wow. And then he sends him on his way. And then what happened?
So now he sends him on his way to allow him to go now and tell everybody. I get now on the intercom system to allow everybody know that it's an intruder alert and there is someone in the building. That this is not a game, that it is for real. He now then proceeds to allow me and tell me to call 911. So I called 911 to tell them what was going on. He now tells me to hang up the phone from 911 and call the news station. And there's plenty of news stations in Atlanta, but I'm not going to kid you. I couldn't even think of one news station, as many as it was. I couldn't even think of one. And so I called the news station, and then he tells me to hang up the phone. So instead of me hanging up the phone, I put the phone on the desk and hit the button so that the 911 operator and the police officers could have eyes and ears on the inside as I was there, allowing them to tell them what he was doing, what was going on, and what he was saying.
That's absolutely amazing. I mean, the presence of mind. And I don't know if I should mention this, but I have to. You had to go to the bathroom, and you had to go to the bathroom bad. And I'm trying to imagine feeling like your teeth are sinking and you're in this stress. I mean, that was an issue for you, wasn't it?
It was so bad. Oh, my God, I had to go to the bathroom so bad. I was like, Lord, hold my mute. Please hold my mute. I had to go to the bathroom so bad.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to. But I'm reading this going, no way.
Yes.
Because when you're in that place, just in itself, it's a four-alarm crisis. Seriously. And so you're in this true crisis, and this is a physical issue for you, and yet God still gave you the presence of mind to keep control. I mean, I'm just awestruck by that.
Yeah. And I asked him, could I go to the bathroom? And he told me yes. And so I had an opportunity to go to the bathroom, and I also had an opportunity to leave. But he was so unstable because by this time he's now has shot the bullet in the office. He's gone out multiple times and has now shot to the police offices. And not only that, you have homes on all around the school where senior citizens and people are there. So he's now shot and emptied his gun everywhere. And so I'm like, if I get up and leave, he is going to now walk these hallways and start just spraying bullets, and everybody in here is going to be dead. So even in the 911 tape, when she asked me, did I have a safe place to leave, to go, I could have ran to anywhere that was probably, to me, safe, but in all reality, would I have been safe?
Yeah. I mean, you probably wouldn't say this about yourself, but you were thinking like a hero even then. I mean, you described this whole thing that you meant to stop and hit the restroom before you got to the office, and then you got the phone call. But so here, this is seriously, you know, an issue, and you have the grace from him for some reason. It seems like he had some kind of grace for you to go to the bathroom, but then you realized, if I do this, it really will open the door to so many things. So then you turned around and came back?
I never got up.
You never got up. Okay.
Never got up. Mm. I tried to get up, and God wouldn't even allow me to move. I mean, I was just that scared. And I'm literally under the desk shaking like a leaf.
Wow.
Because I'm like, I got to go to the bathroom. Can't go to the bathroom. I'm scared as I don't know what. Can't get up. And so it was just a moment that, you know, you say, oh, I wish I could, you know, wish something on my enemy when you get mad and you're frustrated and you're angry. But that's one of the things that no matter what goes on in your life, you don't even wish on your worst enemy.
Wow. Well, what happened after that? Then he got agitated again, didn't he?
So now he's getting agitated and he's pacing back and forth. And so now he tries to commit suicide in there with me.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, we're not doing that. Mm-mm, we're not having suicide moments. I said, because life is worth living for, and we're not doing that. Not killing yourself. We're all going home today. And so now he's saying to me that, you know, you don't understand that I've actually shot everybody. You don't understand I've, you know, shot at the police officers and everything. And I'm like, okay, it doesn't make any difference. No one there is hurt. Everybody is okay. And so you're not going to kill yourself. You ain't going to kill nobody in here. And you ain't going to kill me. And we all going home today.
There you go. What was so amazing is I think he'd called someone. Maybe it was a family member. But he was saying, I've done some really bad things. And you're trying to say in the background, you haven't hurt anybody yet. But it was almost like he'd gone so forward in his mind, he was thinking he'd already done it. Did it sort of seem like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was already convinced in his mind that there was no way out. And the only way out was a suicide or to start shooting everyone. And I'm like, we're not doing that. So that's why I said to him, do you want me to walk out there with you?
And is that when he started to engage with you? Because up to that point, it seemed like he responded to things you said, but wouldn't really fully engage with you. Was there a point?
Well, he never really engaged with me the whole time. He was actually giving demands, speaking, but never saying, okay, yeah, I'll do this for you. Okay, yeah, let's do this. Never did that.
Hmm.
Never had a interaction, conversation. He just gave me demands and what he needed me to do and what he was going to do the whole time.
So I didn't get to this point in your story yet. So where you said you want me to walk out there with you, what happened then?
Well, then I asked the 911 operator, did she, you know, about me walking out there with him. And so she told me to hold on a minute because I knew that the way they were spraying bullets, if me and him both went out there, we would have both been dead. And I know that was not what we needed to do. And so I'm now asking her that on the phone because I know that's not what we need to do because the outcome is not going to be good. But on the other hand, I wanted him to have that much confidence in me that if we went out there together or whatever, that we would both survive.
Hmm. So then what happened?
So then as he's now sitting there and he's now then sprayed up with police and they're actually going back and forth and they have now actually had a shoot 'em up, bang, bang, cowboy experience, bullets flying everywhere. And I'm actually sitting by a big window. So I'm like, okay, come back in here, come back in here. Mm-mm, bullets don't have no names. We ain't dying today. Come back in here, come back in here. And so he now stands there still firing arms and he gets blood. And I don't know if the bullet ricocheted and hit him. I don't know if he cut himself on glass because when they were shooting bullets, glass was breaking from everywhere. So I'm not sure of how he got cut. But then he comes back in once he's seen the blood and everything and comes back in with me. And now he's going back and forth again in his instability and, you know, saying that he hadn't taken his medicine today and just going back and forth. And so I'm now going back to see, okay, now what do we do? So when I look at all that, I know that no matter what, that's why God prepared me for that purpose. And that was one reason why I wanted to write my book, for everybody to know that in spite of what you're going through, I was a normal person that day, nothing else. And with that, that allowed me to be prepared for that purpose that day.
Well, Antoinette, how did the thing end? I mean, did the police come in? Did he surrender? What happened?
So now he's now in there going back and forth. He now puts his weapon, his bullets, and everything on the floor, on the desk beside me. He now goes and puts his water, book bag, and everything on the desk, literally feet away from me. He now lays prostrate before the Lord, put his hands behind his back, waiting for the police officers to come and get him.
Wow. And nobody was shot that day.
Nobody was shot, injured, or anything. That's what you call God being prepared for a purpose to allow me to walk through that.
That is what you call that. Your daughter called during that time, and your phone was on vibrate, and you said you hated having to just not take the call, but you couldn't do that. Did you? What did she say after the fact when she found out you were okay?
Both my kids were excited that I was okay. It was just now, you know, when you're seeing something unfold in news, and see, I didn't know all that was going on. So when you see something unfold itself, then you get a level of terror. And so they were now seeing everything that was going on while I was actually on the inside.
And look what God has done, boy.
Okay.
And I think it's just so important to be listening to him day to day and anchoring yourself, as you say, in the Lord. And Antoinette, we just honor you and we bless you and we just thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you having me on the show today.
Well, God bless you, dear sister. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, we have four copies of Antoinette's book to give away if you're interested in this story. We're going to play a song called You Are My Stronghold. It's by Christy Knuckles back when she and her husband called themselves Watermark. And so if you call in, you'll get a copy. First four to call in, 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. Otherwise, you can email me, but you got to do it right now, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Maybe you're walking through a valley right now. Listen to the words of this song, You Are My Stronghold. In fact, get into Psalm 91. It opens with, He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High God will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. That whole passage in Psalm 91 is a protection psalm. So when you think of that Psalm 91 and you listen to the words of this song, that you are my stronghold. He's our hiding place. He's our refuge. He defends us. And even our circumstances can't make us less because he's made us whole. I love this song. Let's hear it.
Lord, you are my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear if you are near? And Lord, you are my peace when there is war all around me. And even here inside me, I will have no fear. Oh, Lord, you're my protection from my enemies. You set me
He is. He's our stronghold. There's something so powerful about music. And if you're in the valley of the shadow, even if you're not, I think it's good, as Antoinette said, to anchor yourself in him. And so maybe you need a song like that, that just declares the faithfulness of God. I'm going to read from Psalm 23 for you, just as a reminder of who God is to you in whatever season you're in right now. The Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. He lets me rest in green meadows. He leads me beside peaceful streams. He renews my strength. He guides me along right paths, bringing honor to his name. Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I will not be afraid. For you, Lord, are close beside me. Your rod and your staff, they protect and comfort me. You prepare a feast for me in the presence of my enemies. You honor me by anointing my head with oil. My cup overflows with blessings. Surely your goodness and unfailing love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, I really pray you found some encouragement here today, especially if you're walking through a valley. And I always say, nobody is born to live and die in the valley. We pass through the valley of the shadow. And so remember that. If this is a hard time for you, you're passing through. Don't give up hope. Keep trusting. Keep believing. And there's going to be a suddenly one day. It's coming for you, I promise. And I want to remind you, you know, we did this faith and fitness thing last summer. It was such a hit that we're going to kind of reengage it in a brand new way. And so for Lent, maybe instead of just like maybe giving up chocolate, I'm not minimizing that, but I'm going to ask you to join us on a faith and fitness 40-day journey leading up to prepare our hearts and minds for Easter. You can sign up. It's for free on our website, myfaithradio.com, but a 40-day faith and fitness challenge. So we're going to implement a physical and spiritual element each week just to engage our whole selves in the preparation for Easter. And so look for that on our website, myfaithradio.com. My anchor holds within the veil. So glad you tuned in today. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. You can find a podcast of today's show up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Don't forget to sign up for our 40-day faith and fitness challenge. It starts March 3rd. Sign up now. It's free. One word I want to leave you with that Philip Yancey said. He quoted Dallas Willard, "In this world, nothing irredeemable can happen to you." Hope that brings you courage today. Everyday Relationships is up next. And finally, I'll leave you with this. The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. And he's the one who keeps you strong to the end. Have a great day.